I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. But before we talk to Mark, osprey expert Rob Beauregard has written a children's book, Belle's Journey, An Osprey Takes Flight. He stopped by a couple of weeks ago to chat about it. Rob, thanks for dropping in. Nice to see you.
A pleasure. Great to be here.
So you've been tracking osprey migration with radio transmitters for what, last 16 years or
18
so?
18 years.
18 years now. Okay, so talk about some of the observations you've made through that work.
Well, I think the most fascinating observation we've had is based on the young, naive ospreys that I've tagged on Martha's Vineyard. We had tagged a lot of adult ospreys on the vineyard in the East Coast, and we know they all go from here west over Long Island, down the coast to Florida, Cuba, Hispaniola, and then on spread out in South America. What we didn't know, and what I discovered when I started tagging young ospreys, is that more than half of the young ospreys on Martha's Vineyard get to South Beach, and their little brain says, go south, so they do, and they fly over 1,200 miles of open Atlantic Ocean to the Bahamas.
Wow.
And no one knew that they were doing this. We knew that there were some ospreys seen out there, but we didn't know that as many young ospreys make that crossing as do. And the really cool thing is there are no adults that do that. So what we've figured out is that when those young come north on their first trip north, after they do a gap year down in Brazil, they do 18 months in South America. And their first trip north, they just sort of head north, and they don't have a map in their little osprey brain. They just have a simple little program that says, go north, stay over land if at all possible. If you can't stay over land, just go north. If you follow those rules, you get to South America, go across the Caribbean, you get to the Bahamas, and if you happen to, like Belle, the osprey in the book, if you happen to have come over the Atlantic, you don't go back over the Atlantic. You see the Bahama Islands ahead of you, and they're north. So you island hop through the Bahamas, you find Florida, you work your way up the coast, you find your parents, and you ask them, why didn't you tell me I didn't have to fly 1,000 miles over the Atlantic Ocean to get to South America? And of course the parents say, well, you wouldn't have listened to me anyway, so I didn't bother. So that's what we've discovered, is that the young birds learn their migration route almost through trial and error by following a very simple little algorithm in their brain. In science, the simplest explanation is almost always the right one. And so you can get ospreys doing what they do by simply following these simple rules. In the fall, go south, stay over land if you can. If you can't, just go south, and flip that around in the spring, and you get, after Belle's fourth migration cycle, she was doing exactly what all the adults do. Yeah. It was really cool to see that.
That is so interesting. So Belle's Journey is about an osprey who in the spring leaves Brazil for her annual migration to Martha's Vineyard. And this is really based on your actual research. It's not all Belle. You've combined the journey of a few birds, right? Three birds?
Right. So it's Belle is a story. Belle is a composite. It's mostly based on Belle, who was born in 2010 on Lake Teshmu. We put a radio on her that late July and followed her trip to south up to Brazil and in 2010, back in 2012. So when I decided to write the book, I actually put together the travels of four different young ospreys. Most of what happens in the book happened to Belle. I borrowed three other ospreys, southbound and northbound migrations. But everything, the book is, the style, the genre, if you will, is narrative nonfiction. So everything that happens in the book happened to one of my ospreys. Some of the adventures there I sort of imagined, but I know that those sorts of things have happened to ospreys. So when we were in the editing process, we had to be very careful about not anthropomorphizing. Belle doesn't have human emotions. Mm-hmm. A few had slipped in in the first draft, but they were quickly chopped out by my editrix and my editor.
So why a kid's book? Why not write this as, you know, just like for adults? Why did you decide a kid's book was the way to go?
Well, I've done it for adults, and that's in the form of all my scientific journals. And I've sort of got at least the technical side of it. Some of that data is out. I've got a mountain of data that I still got to analyze and publish. But the suggestion was made to me in 2013. We were waiting to catch an osprey over in Chappaquiddick, and Bill Bryan, who was over visiting, watching the trapping process. Well, he was actually watching the trapping process not happen because our target bird had gone off to explore the world. So while we were waiting for that bird to come back, Bill, the conversation went around and around, and finally Bill said, "Why don't you write a kid's book?" And I hadn't thought about it, but I said, "Well, I will." And he suggested the model is a book called Paddle to the Sea by Holling Clancy Holling, which is a famous kid's book, Caldecott Award winner, and a great model for this. So I went home and visited what my brother was visiting, and I sat down and stream of consciousness came up with a storyline for the adventures that a young osprey would have on his or her first voyage from South America, from Brazil, or from Martha's Vineyard to South America and back. And I sort of put together these composite of these four different ospreys and started writing. And 5 months later, I had a book.
And the book is illustrated by Kate Grichinski, who does beautiful illustrations. She's done a number of children's books. And Mark Faraday is here with us now. Morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you haven't had a chance to check out the book yet, have you? I should mention, that's a portion of the interview. We're going to play the whole interview we did with Rob probably the first week of July, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, good. Rob's great.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the book. I think it's above my grade level. I'm glad he wrote it. I'm sure it's great. We worked with Rob tracking an osprey, an East Ham osprey, back, it's like almost 10 years ago now, but not quite. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, there's nothing like satellite tracking your study. And as a biologist, there's nothing like it. And it's hard to go back.
Yeah.
You know, knowing where your focus animal is at any given second, you know, in real time, it's just addictive. And this bird that we tracked, this osprey, a young osprey from a nest at Boat Meadow in East Ham, just took the craziest migration route. You know, who would have known otherwise?
Right,
you never would have known.
Right.
And, you know, Rob's the master at this. And it just, this bird went, you know, over to the mainland of Massachusetts from East Ham, went up to P-Town, then flew across, was up in New Hampshire briefly for some reason, then to the Connecticut River Valley, and then down the Connecticut River, and then up the Delaware water gap, up into Pennsylvania, like rural Pennsylvania, stayed there until like November, and then did a normal migration down through Cape May, the eastern shore of Virginia, and then out over the Atlantic to Cuba and down to Venezuela, which is a very
See the sights.
Very typical. Yeah, young, and, you know, it's like young, like college grads going
right.
to Europe to find themselves. These ospreys do the same thing. They go, you know, this one went to Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania to find herself. And then she was atypical in another way. She hung out in Venezuela for, you know, like a month, couple of months. And we just assumed that's where she'd be for the next 18 months because they stay down there for a year and a half before they come back to try to breed. And I stopped paying attention. And then all of a sudden, this bird just flew 800 miles further south into Amazonia.
Hmm.
It was amazing. And Rob was like, "Did you see what Goody?" We named this bird Goody Hallett after the legend, the legend in East Ham there. It was just bizarre. I mean, this bird, and then just disappeared into heart of darkness, Amazonia, and we never heard from her again.
Ugh.
We like to think she's still out there somewhere. But
let's hope so.
It was a lot of fun tracking that bird with Rob. Yeah.
All right, so let's chat a little about the weather. It's been kind of cool. Is that impacting our birds in any way?
I don't know. I mean, if you live on Cape Cod, whether you're a bird or a person, you get used to cool springs.
Yeah.
You know. Temperatures in the 40s and overnight in June is not that unusual for this part of the world. I think they're fine.
They're fine. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We have the summer seabirds coming back, right? A lot of summer
seabirds.
Yeah,
yeah. The old and the new. So, first of all, there's just an unusual number of winter birds still around.
Still. Yeah, because they're saying it's cool nights.
Yeah. People are seeing razorbills out on razorbills are very much a winter seabird, these alcids. And somebody saw like seven hanging out in Cape Cod Bay.
Wow.
Very unusual for June. There's some snowy owls around. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. That's very unusual, too. But the summer seabirds are coming in. The birds that you see when you go on your summer whale watch when the family comes to visit in July and August, the great shearwaters are just coming in. Up from, the Tristan da Cunha Islands, the middle of the South Atlantic, way down south towards Antarctica. Same with the Wilson storm petrels, who also breed down there in giant colonies. They've made their way north, spanning the entire Atlantic Ocean, and are just starting to arrive in our waters, where they'll be for the whole summer, feeding in these really productive waters that we have around Stillwagon Bank and east of Chatham, places like that. And so all four, well, at least three species of shearwater are in. Corey's shearwaters are more warm water oriented, and they'll be coming in soon. But yeah, we'll probably hear from our friend on the whale watch.
We'll see.
Later on, maybe we'll talk more about that. But yeah, so certainly signs of summer there on the ocean, which is nice.
All right. So tell me about the Monomoy Tern census. It just collected those numbers? You were part of that, right, counting?
Yeah. I mean, I go over to help them out now and again. It's a fun thing to do. They look for volunteers to help with the census, and it's grueling. This was a 14-hour day. It's tough. I mean, boating around Chatham anymore. You can't boat in the Southway at all anymore, really. Mm-hmm. So you have to go out of Stage Harbor and go all the way around and get down there, and it's not easy. But the Tern census is just, there's nothing like it. I mean, being surrounded by 25,000 birds that all want you dead, there's nothing like it. I mean, really, they hate you. You know, they don't know you.
They think you're after their eggs.
You tell them, I'm a bird guy. I'm just trying to help. Yeah. You know, and they're like, no, get out of here now. Yeah. Right.
Because they don't see a lot of people there either.
Right. I mean, it's a wilderness area, and nobody really is, the north end of South Monomoy is not a place where people go. People go to the south end sometimes, or the lighthouses down there, and people clam the flats, but they don't go up into the mainland or the upland parts of it, really. And so, yeah, but people live in the colony. The researchers live in the colony, both Monomoy and Mass Audubon. Mm. They have a little tented shanty town there. Mm. The research techs, comfortable little community with a couple of tents and a cook tent and whatever, because they're there every day studying these terns. They're doing productivity plots where they have little plots where they track, they follow every nest very closely, look at how many chicks they're producing, which nests fail, which nests succeed, that kind of thing, so they can estimate the productivity of the whole colony. You're obviously not going to follow 12,000 nests with a crew of five people or whatever, so you follow a subset of them, and then you extrapolate up, which is what they do. But they try to count every nest. And you do that, you form a line, and you sweep back and forth through the colony in a grid system that they have set up. And it takes a couple of days with a couple of lines of, 10 people each, and you count every single nest that you can.
And then you've got a snowy owl there picking off some of the terns?
Yeah, there's still a snowy owl. There's still one on Nantucket, too. It's really, really unusual to have one staying into May. And now we're approaching mid-June, and they're still there. And so these are birds that obviously decided they're not going to go back to the Arctic and breed. And when you're surrounded by that much food...
Why do I need to leave?
Yeah, I mean, we're going through doing our census, and we'd come across a little raised area in the colony, like, 2 feet high, a little mound. And it'd be covered in tern wings. Mm-mm. And there'd be pellets next to it. Like, oh, the snowy, these weren't here yesterday.
Oops.
And so this is where the snowy was plucking his terns last night. And certainly there's enough terns there to feed an owl for a little bit. But, the colony is still very much intact, and they're not abandoning, so that's fine.
And there's a couple hundred laughing gulls?
A couple thousand laughing gulls,
okay.
Yeah.
That's 200 here. That's left a zero off.
2,000
laughing gulls. Now, they come back in June. When are they here?
They come back in April and May.
April and May. Okay, I love them. They are such pretty birds.
Oh yeah, they really are. They have personality.
I mean, they're the best gull.
Good sense of humor.
Best.
You know what's not to like? They really do laugh. Although they're not laughing when you're in their nesting colony.
No, they
take on a different tone.
They also want you to leave.
They don't sound angry. They sound sad. Why are you here?
Yeah, please leave me alone.
Ordinarily, they do really sound like they're laughing.
Yeah, they're great birds.
Very mirthful. Yeah. And they're good-looking gulls. And pretty much all of the ones that breed in Massachusetts are in that colony. I mean, that is the colony. And same with the common terns. Mm-hmm. I mean, common terns, used to be a big colony on Plymouth Beach. That's sort of kaput now. They're on the islands in Buzzards Bay where the roseates are, but common terns, it's like there's two big colonies on the East Coast. There's Monomoy and there's Great Gull Island and Long Island Sound, and that's it. And they're both about the same size. They're both huge.
Wow.
And so that's, a bird that's that common tern, there's 20,000 on that island. How could they be listed? It's a state-listed species. But why? And it's because they're literally putting all their eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
They haven't heard the old adage, apparently. Yeah, I mean, in Massachusetts, it's essentially one basket. So if something catastrophic happened to the tern colony on South Monomoy,
it'd be trouble, yeah.
That's 90% of your common tern population in Massachusetts. Wild. So it's that vulnerability that leads to them being listed as a state-protected species.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I've said birds for so long. We'll talk about anything. Butterflies, dragonflies, animals.
Oh, yes,
yeah, anything.
Mammals.
We'll talk about
herps.
It. Yep. Janet in Wellfleet says, I have seen this female red-bellied woodpecker at my jelly feeder on two occasions. I had no idea they would eat jelly. I have also seen a sparrow and a pair of crows eating from the feeder. And she sent us a nice photo. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, birds have more varied diets than people realize. And I've heard of all kinds of different things, taking advantage of those jelly feeders. And you hear about chickadees trying to drink from hummingbird feeders and that kind of thing. A lot of these birds are fairly smart and adaptable, and they'll try new food sources. So, I mean, it's just what you need. It's hard to keep those grape jelly feeders full.
Yeah.
The catbirds just gulp that stuff down. Even if the orioles aren't there, the catbirds find it very quickly and just gulp that stuff down. And so you don't need other things eating it too. So,
yeah. All right, AT is calling us from Nantucket. Good morning.
Good morning. I love this program. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you.
I have a couple of things. I was very lucky to spend the spring in Falmouth. And, here on Nantucket, we have ospreys, and they're great. But you guys make such a big... Now I understand why. They come in herds. and I might see one osprey with a fish, a season, which is very cool. I was seeing two a day with fish. And I thought, I get it now. Now I get it. But here's my real question. We have some lovely Carolina wrens who made a nest in our natural gas top, which I thought was interesting. And they've already had their brood and whatnot, and I think they've fletched. But will they brood again this season, or is it okay to clear out that nest?
You can clear out the nest. They'll build another one. So songbirds generally don't reuse their nests that they build. They tend to fill up with poop and mites and things like that. It's not sanitary for them to reuse them, especially in the same season as the insect load will just get heavier. You can clean that out. I mean, you clean out bluebird boxes to start the season, clean out last year's stuff.
Yeah.
I wouldn't worry about that. But that's a classic.
No, it's really nice that they nested there.
It's a classic nesting location for Carolina wrens is the top of your propane tank.
Mm.
Because it's covered, and they like that. It's got that, little entrance hole on the side, and they build their domed nest in there. They've done it at the sanctuary in Wellfleet.
We were thrilled because we thought they usually migrated through, but apparently not.
Mm-hmm. No, they're not a migrant at all. They don't go anywhere.
They're year-round
residents.
This year, I've seen more towhees this year than I've ever seen on Nantucket.
Good. Yeah, they're super, super common on Nantucket. They're considered a declining shrubland bird regionally, but when you go to Nantucket with the bare oak thickets and the moors and whatever, it's ideal habitat for them. Shrubby oaks, whether it's in the understory of a forest or just bare oak as far as you can see, that's what they like. And so they do pretty well on the Cape and Islands, especially in Nantucket.
Yeah. A.T., I want to mention to you, since you're on Nantucket, you know the Nantucket Book Festival is coming up. And Rick Prum, who is a ornithologist, author of The Evolution of Beauty, and I guess a feather expert, he's going to be talking on Friday at noon at the Athenaeum Great Hall. So you might want to check that out.
I will be there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, and anybody else who's interested.
I love your show, Mindy.
Thanks.
Keep going.
Thank you for calling. 866-999-4626. And you know Richard.
Rick's good friend of Vern's, and he spoke during one of the Nantucket Birding Festivals. Really good talk. Really bright guy, and he's a little bit of an iconoclast in the kind of evolutionary theory world, sexual selection. There's certain orthodoxies, the post-Darwinian theories of sexual selection. And he's kind of coming out and saying, I think animals just appreciate beauty kind of like we do.
Well, he says, brings us a theory of mate selection in birds and animals that is passionate, witty, and all too relevant to human beings. If you are a man or a woman interested in science, art, or sex, you will want to hear what Prum has to show.
Or sex. I like how they throw that in there. Yeah.
Try to get you. It'll definitely be worth checking out.
Just following up on that last call, AT from Nantucket, I'm curious what kind of other interesting nesting situations people have. Weird places birds are nesting around
your
yard.
You have one right now, don't you?
Yeah, so I feel these kinds of calls all the time. Like, oh, I've got a bird nesting in my hanging plant in my back door or whatever, the back light. And I try to figure out what it is for
house
them.
Finch.
It's usually a house finch. But Carolina wrens love nesting around and on houses. In houses, there are some cool stories out there. But I had a pair, building a nest on basically a planter that's mounted to the side of the house right outside our back door, or back door out onto our deck. That's where we go in and out. It's where all of our activity is. Dog hangs out on the deck. And they were building, and I was like, well, that I don't know if that'll last. And then it seemed like the activity sort of fell off. I wasn't seeing them as much. I was like, oh, we must have bothered them too much. And then I go look in it a week later, and there's 6 eggs. Hmm. The bird comes blasting out by my face. I'm like, oops. And so they've got a nest right outside our busiest entrance and exit there on our deck where we hang out all the time. So they love being around people. They're perfectly happy to nest in planters. And like I said, they love the tops of propane tanks. Check yours if you haven't looked in a while. Right. You might find a Carolina wren nest in there.
Well, that reminds me. Amy had a robin's nest outside her front door. I think it might have been on the light. I'm not sure, but they had the blue. Unfortunately, something got up to the eggs.
Yeah.
And so her question was what asked earlier, will they brood again? Maybe not in the same nest. But so when they come back and they go, oh, my babies are gone, do they just immediately go, let's go build a new nest?
Yeah, they'll re-nest.
Yeah.
Lots of things re-nest. I mean, piping plovers will re-nest up to 5 times in a season.
Wow, 5 times?
Crows just get so many of their nests at the egg stage that they'll, 3-4 re-nests is pretty common, but they'll re-nest up to 5 times. Longer, it depends on how long the breeding cycle is. So small birds have a quick breeding cycle, songbird, 2 weeks in the, build the nest, then 2 weeks in the egg and 2 weeks in the chick stage, and then they're fledged. Something like an osprey or a bald eagle, they have to start really early and they get one chance. Mm-hmm. There's no, if you lose a nest 6 weeks into the nesting season, that's it. There's no re-nesting because they wouldn't have enough time to, incubate those eggs and raise those chicks and get them fledged before it's time to migrate.
And they would never move babies, right? A robin would never move eggs or little babies.
No, they don't.
So when they're gone, something got them.
Their bill wouldn't allow
them.
Right. Yeah. There's a heavy predation on
squirrels,
bird nests, chipmunks, mice,
chipmunks,
squirrels,
wow,
blue jays, crows, snakes, all kinds of things eat bird nests. And the ones that nest on the ground are particularly vulnerable, and that's why things like Bob Whites and whippoorwills are not as common as they used to be. These are ground nesters, and so, they're even more vulnerable to things like cats. Mm-hmm. And then the really high number of foxes and coyotes that we have compared to historical levels. I mean, 500 years ago, there were probably none of either, definitely no coyotes.
Yeah.
Ground nesting birds have it tough. But I remember when I lived in Arizona, I was working on a project there on a river, a desert river bird research project down there. and some Say's phoebes nested on our back porch light, just like eastern phoebes do up here, you know, nesting under the eaves of outbuildings and things like that. And so I'm following this nest, and we had these mirrors that we would use to check nests because we were monitoring nests all through our study areas, and have this mirror on an extension, and I would check this nest, and the chicks are getting bigger, and we're very attached to this nest. The chicks are getting bigger. And then I'd say a day before they were going to fledge, I went out there, and there's a gopher snake draped across the nest with four bumps, lumps in him, the chicks. And the adults, you know, talk about anthropomorphize, something you try not to do as a researcher, but the calls coming from the two adults were just the most mournful sound I've ever heard.
They
put a lot of work into these chicks, and, you know, it was the day before fledging, and then this stupid snake comes along and eats all four. But that's the reality.
Yeah, it's tough.
You monitor bird nests, you just that's what happens. You know, they get eaten, and then they have to try again, and you hope they're successful the next time.
All right. Anthony's calling from East Ham. Hi, Anthony.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, great show. I always enjoy it.
Thank you.
Two questions. Ospreys, when they're flying over the land, do they are they only fish eaters, or will they eat an occasional other animal if they're far from a pond or a lake? My second question is, oh, go ahead.
No, ask them both.
My second question is, I've been living in East Ham for many years, and as a child, we'd always see flocks of quail, and as you just said, Bob White, and I think you partially answered this one, where are they gone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We get that Bob White question a lot.
Yeah, where are the Bob Whites? People miss hearing that sound. So osprey, pretty much only fish. I mean, I think there are reports of them eating other things, and, you know, maybe they'll grab a snake or something like that. Hey, it's an eel. You know, snake tries to swim across a pond, and osprey will probably grab that and bring it back. But a lot of people are confused by this, but it's really pretty much all fish. And so sometimes people see them landing on beaches, like basically swooping down like you would expect a hawk grabbing a bird or something to do. And so some people wonder if they're eating piping plovers and that kind of thing. But when they're doing that, when they're swooping down onto a beach, they're just carrying off seaweed to line their nest with. They maintain their nest all through the nesting season. They'll add new stuff to it. They'll add trash, T-shirts they find. You know, we've seen all kinds of things. A broom was in one.
Oh, my goodness.
Fishing rods.
Huh.
I mean, they add all kinds of things to their nests, and they keep decorating them throughout the nesting season. But they love to take picked seaweed off of beaches. And so they're not grabbing plovers or whatever. They're just getting material for their nests.
And then the second question was
about the Bob Whites. Yeah, Bob Whites are, they're basically in the process of being extirpated from the northeastern U.S. They've gone from Connecticut and New York, other states in New England. and it's a little bit complicated. They were sort of hunted out, and then the Bob White that we've had the last, I don't know, 50, 100 years or more, were basically stocked birds. You know, so genetically, probably not the same birds that were here before the colonists arrived, which I think was sort of a bigger, more locally adapted subspecies that, you know, well adapted to Cape Cod. And I think they've been gone for a long time. But now even the restocked birds that constitute the modern population, they're on their way out too. When I started at the sanctuary, it was just 2007, 2008. And I think there were three different pairs and 40 chicks that year at the sanctuary. They've been gone for 6 years now.
Wow.
There are no Bob Whites. The fox population was super, super high for about 4 years on the Outer Cape before mange kicked in a couple of years ago and brought it back down again. And then feral cats. I mean, I saw feral cats hunting Bob Whites on our sanctuary. They're coming over from a neighboring property. You know, it's a wildlife sanctuary, but we can't, you know, prevent that from happening.
Right.
And so cats are really bad news for ground nesting birds like Bob Whites. And like I said, whippoorwills. Whippoorwills tend to be in somewhat wilder places where they're maybe less susceptible to cats, but certainly foxes and coyotes can get them. And
Anthony, thanks for the call. John is calling from Chatham. Hi, John.
Good morning. Three parts to this question. When does your book go on sale? If I bring one to the bring a copy to the Wildlife Center, would you autograph it? And would you be kind enough to read a Chatham Anglers program, because you will see two ospreys featured in it?
Sure, I'll sign it. I didn't write it, but I'll sign it for you. It won't do you much good. But
I think Rob has got. I know he's got something. If it hasn't already happened at one of the bookstores on the Vineyard, but I would maybe check out his website and see when he's going to be around. I'm sure he's got some book signings coming up, and we'll try to put a link on our website for that, so you can get Rob to sign it. He wrote it. Yeah.
Yeah. Rob piece was pre-recorded.
Yeah, he stopped in a couple weeks ago.
Okay. Well, I look forward to reading it.
Good. All right. Well, thanks, John. Appreciate that.
Okay. Good luck.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thanks. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. And Mark's question, you have any unusual nesting sites happening in your yard? Let us know. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Well, we're talking about nests, ravens, common ravens. We've got, you know, for a while there, we knew there was a nesting pair, but there are more?
Yeah, all of a sudden. And some of us sort of suspected this. So when was it? Five, six years ago at least, ravens were discovered nesting on a catwalk at the power plant on the canal in Sandwich. So, yeah, on the Cape, sort of, just the other side of the canal. But they were, you know, they were Cape birds. And then just in the last few weeks, I heard about two different new raven nests that I didn't know about. One in Truro on a cell phone tower. And then another one in kind of the industrial part of Harwich, Dennis, that area there. And that one was in a tree, but in a really busy place.
Hmm.
Right. This is where all the, you know, kind of industrial parks are and that kind of thing. And so this is what's happened with ravens. I mean, ravens used to be a bird of wilderness in the Northeast anyway. They're a little more widespread in the West. But common ravens was a bird of, you know, Maine and northern New Hampshire 20, 30 years ago. And then they started recolonizing Massachusetts. They were hunted out in colonial times as, you know, predators on young livestock. They would eat the eyes out of the lambs and things like that. So they just shot out all the ravens. And then also the forests were gone. They were all cut down and for farming and lumber and whatever. And so it took not shooting them anymore, as well as the slow regrowth of the forests here in Massachusetts to allow them to start coming back. And boy, are they coming back. And they're not just coming back to forested areas. They're nesting on fire escapes at Wellesley College.
Huh.
And, you know, Verizon Towers in Brockton, all basically urban places. And I think the first urban places they started nesting were quarries. You know, there was a quarry in West Roxbury, which it ends up looking like natural cliffs, you know, like craggy cliffs, which is a normal place where they would nest. And so that made sense. But I think once they got a taste of the cities and the suburbs, they're just like, there's plenty of food here, plenty of places to nest, you know, whatever. And now they'll nest just about anywhere. And so I expect their population to just continue to grow here on the Cape, and people will be finding more and more nests. They're much bigger than a crow.
Bigger beak,
longer wings, more pointed wings, longer kind of diamond-shaped tail. They're really cool birds. The sounds they make are much different than crows. Deep kind of. What do you think, Dan?
I don't think he has any.
Okay, nothing. I'm not going to imitate them either. You know what they sound. But they sound a lot different than crows. But just keep an eye out for them. I often see them when I'm driving down Route 6, or I seldom see them. But when I do, I'm usually driving down Route 6. Like, hey, ravens flying across. I wonder if they're nesting nearby. And increasingly, they probably are. Really smart, very, very smart, very adaptable birds. So.
Are they as smart as crows?
They're smarter than crows,
smarter
probably.
Smarter than crows, really?
Bigger brain, yeah, I don't
know.
Well, who knows? But
yeah. There's been a lot of research done on crows, you know, on their intelligence.
There's been a lot of research
yeah.
done on ravens, too. Yeah, Bernd Heinrich, that famous book, mm-hmm. Mind of the Raven.
Yeah.
The New Caledonian crows there
right.
from the Pacific Rim, they're really... You know, I mean, those things are doing calculus to make it sound like some of the researchers. I don't know about some of that. They have
smart,
them solving like 12-step problems
That's
to
crazy,
get a food reward.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's adults, humans I know who can't do the things
That's
that
right.
the New Caledonian crows can do.
It gives a new meaning to bird brain, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, I'll take that. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so bring us up to date on the new pollinator garden. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. So we saved a bunch of plants from the previous pollinator garden there at Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary in the fall, overwintered them in pots, and then some new ones started, some of the old ones started coming up again this spring. So we saved all of those, we moved them around, we put in a pathway so you can get into the interior of it now, which was nice. I wanted people to really be able to get a more intimate experience with the garden. Before, it was kind of big and you couldn't see into the middle very well. So now you can get right in there. There is some stuff blooming in there, but Friday is going to be our first big planting day with new plants. Mm. We're working with Blue Flax Design, a company that does landscape design, and donating their time very generously and helping us get plants and put the final design together. And we're still looking for volunteers, but we're going to be putting in a bunch of plants on Friday morning at 9. If people are interested, they can get in touch with us at the sanctuary or get in touch with me. Our volunteer coordinator is out for a little bit. But
And how are you determining what plants you're putting in there?
I've been obsessively researching this for years. And just in my own, you know, I'm a butterfly enthusiast, and I do things with butterfly surveys. I'm involved with the Mass Butterfly Club, listserv, and things like that. It's just one of my passions. I love insects. I love plant-pollinator interactions. I'm trying to get better at learning native bees. It's something that I'm fascinated with insects and the relationships between insects and plants in particular. And so I've been watching what works and what doesn't for a long time, and exist in the previous garden, in my own gardens, trying different plants, and then researching what plants work. And it's hard to get good information, especially at your local nurseries. They don't really know anything at the local nurseries about native plants and pollinators and things like that. They really don't. And so you have to do your own research. And a lot of plants will be misleadingly labeled as pollinator-friendly, and it turns out that that cultivar doesn't really produce any nectar or pollen and doesn't attract bees. And people are just starting to research this. There's a woman named Annie White who did her PhD work at the University of Vermont, looking at this idea of straight native species versus the cultivars that the nursery industry has produced for different plants that are commonly sold at nurseries. And what she found was that some of these cultivars do not attract pollinators the way the original species does. And so she planted all these plants in an experimental grid and watched them over time. She'd had them paired, like a native species with one of its cultivars, like native, you know, the straight Echinacea purple coneflower that so many people have, that's a really good butterfly plant. Monarchs love it. All kinds of bees and butterflies love it. And paired that with some of the kind of frilly cultivars and things that you can get, and looked at, you know, what pollinators visited it. And it turned out that some of the cultivars were just pretty useless for attracting pollinators compared to the straight species. Others were, you know, about the same. Some of the, like the common black-eyed Susan cultivar that you get at nurseries is Goldsturm. I'm sure every nursery is selling that right now. It's Rudbeckia fulgida Goldsturm, which is a common black-eyed Susan that people plant. And I think that was about the same in terms of being able to attract pollinators. But others were not. There was one cultivar of culver's root that actually was more attractive to pollinators than the straight species. It was a lavender.
You're gonna have to check her
lavender
stuff out.
Towers, and I know you can get that at some of the local nurseries. Yeah. But if you go to Annie White, she has a website called pollinatorgardens.org where you can look at her research results, look at her top 10 plants for pollinators, You know, I looked at that, and I looked at there are online nurseries that sell native plants where you can get relatively obscure native things that your local nurseries definitely won't sell. You can get straight species as opposed to the cultivars that your nurseries won't sell online, places like Prairie Nursery, Prairie Moon. There's one called North Creek, but they pretty much just service professionals. It's, there's not a consumer level one, but they also have a lot of good information on their websites.
All right, good to know.
These online native plant nurseries. There's a native seed project based out of Maine that's worth Googling up. A lot of good information about plants, including, you know, what works for shade, what works for dry, sandy soil, that kind of thing, you know, bloom time. So you can really plan a pollinator garden.
Let's talk to Lee, who's giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Okay. I have a lot of indoor birds, but I feed outdoor birds. And I have two feeders of raw sunflower hearts, which everyone loves, thistle, suet. And I would like to put out, big, thick slices of orange inside a suet feeder, but no one's found it yet. Will they? I mean, I just haven't seen anyone at that feeder.
It's pretty late to put out oranges. I mean, you get mixed results with trying to attract orioles, and people put out oranges for orioles. Other things will certainly visit it. I've even had a butterfly visit an orange I put out. I had a red-spotted purple butterfly visit an orange to drink from it. But, you know, people get mixed results with orioles. If it's not out there in the beginning of May when they first arrive, they may not find it or sort of imprint on your house as a place to get oranges. But other things might eat them. I mean, if nothing finds them, I would just skip it and try again next, like, the beginning of May.
Got it. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks, Leigh.
Sure.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
All right. So you mentioned insects. Now, Janet wants to know if you know what this picture of this insect is. Look, by the look on your face, I'm thinking maybe not.
It looks like a stonefly.
A stonefly, maybe?
It's one I would have to Google. Okay. The site that I use, I mean, there's thousands of species of insects. It's so much harder than birds. It's just.
And Janet, I'll hang on to this. Roberta, who's also an entomologist, she might know, so we'll hold on to it for when she's here next week.
Yeah, I'd have to, I can't see the screen very well. The sun's in my eyes. I've got a lot of excuses, but there's a great site called bugguide.net, and that's where I go to confirm. You know, I can usually guess the family, or I can do pretty well with insects, get it to order at least. But it's an expert. It's basically a crowdsourced way to identify insects, because there's no field guide that's going to identify every insect.
That's for sure. There's too many.
There is a good one for New England by a guy named Tom Murray, who's also a birder, lives in Central Mass. It's Insects of New York and New England or something like that. It's a really good field guide for insects. But bugguide.net, you post a picture, you create an account, post a picture, and then some bug geek in a basement laboratory at some university who's the one expert in the world on that obscure family of flies or whatever says, oh, actually, that's this.
Yeah.
And then they post it, they put it in the right place on the website. Yeah. So it's a really good resource. And I encourage people to get into insects, pay attention to the insects in your yard, what's visiting your flowers, get into those adorable little native bees, watch what they do.
Let's go back to the pollinator garden for a second, because I'm wondering what your thoughts are. And, you know, people like to pull all their weeds. I let some of the Queen Anne's lace. I let the milkweed. I had a hard time getting the milkweed to take. Now I've got it. It's like everywhere.
Common milkweed is probably not the best thing to try to get established in your yard, because then you'll be battling it.
Yeah.
I recommend people use swamp milkweed. Really good, well-behaved garden plant. Research has shown that monarchs actually prefer it in terms of laying their eggs sometimes. And then on the Cape, we can do the butterfly weed, the beautiful orange.
Yeah, that's great.
Asclepias tuberosa. So I would stick with those. Common milkweed is literally people are handing it out, and there's some well-intentioned folks, you know, handing out seeds and stuff to help monarchs, and you know, that's great in power lines and places like that. I wouldn't put it in your yard. I mean, this is a sidewalk crack weed. It's a very insistent plant. But it's good to have around. We have it on the sanctuary, but not a well-behaved garden plant.
I have one little section where I want it to be that finally it's starting to, and where I don't want it to be is where I'm pulling it. That's where it really wants to be.
That's exactly how, that's why. But there's so many what we call weeds out there, even the non-native ones, all the hawkweeds, things that look like tall dandelions right now that are blooming everywhere. If you watch a patch of that, it's covered in native bees. I mean, they've come to depend on it. They had to adapt to this new landscape. I mean, all the plants we bring in are from Asia or Europe. Every garden plant at a nursery is from Asia or Europe. For some reason, we've just decided to turn our backyards into Japan. I don't know why the nursery trade works that way.
And to be fair, there are some that do grow their own and do some local stuff. I'll give you the names.
Okay. It's really hard to find local stock. Yeah. I mean, the closest you can usually get is Pennsylvania in terms of ecotypes for plants.
All right, so let's wrap up with migration. We're sort of seeing the last tier of the spring migration. We've been talking about all these different sets. Now the summer birds are coming in, or the summer shore birds. Is everybody here?
May happened since the last time we talked, and so the whole warbler migration, the bulk of the songbird migration that we all look forward to every mid-May, that's all happened since we last talked, and. The warbler migration happened after Birdathon for at least like the third time in the last 4 years, which is kind of a bummer. But when it does come, it's just glorious. It was a really good warbler migration for about 5 days in mid-May. Beautiful birds like Cape May warbler, Blackburnian warbler, Bay-breasted warbler. Look these birds up if you don't know what I'm talking about. You kind of have to know what they sound like or really know how to look for these guys to realize they're around. I had them in my yard every day for 4 or 5 days. A Cape May warbler is often hard to find just in the tree above my deck in the oaks. I mean, if you have oaks, you probably have some of these sought-after spring warblers that we look forward to coming through. And it was a great year. And it's linked back. This is one reason birds are so cool. This links back to an insect outbreak in the spruce forests of remote parts of Canada last year that allowed birds like Cape May warbler that are closely linked to these outbreaks to produce lots and lots of chicks. And then some percentage of those chicks survived the winter and came back. And so we had more than usual Cape May warblers on the Cape this May because of an insect in Canada last, spring.
It's all connected, isn't
it? It's all connected. Yeah. Birds are so cool.
Yeah. And then if you find a baby bird, just leave it alone. Watch it. Because mom is probably close by, right?
Yeah. Well, there are questions to be answered. Usually, like robins is the common one. Because robins fledge before they leave the nest before it seems like they should have, and people get confused because you have this incompetent-looking bird
kind of clumsily
hopping around, making a sound. But if you watch it for long enough, you'll realize the adults know exactly where it is, as well as its brothers and sisters. They stash them in different places, and they come and feed them every so often. They know where they are. They key in on that special sound that robins only make when they're a fledgling. And they find them. There are certainly, if you find a naked bird, chick with its eyes closed under a nest, then it fell out and something's wrong. You can put it back. Yeah. Put it back in the nest. There's no scent. When your kids, don't touch a baby bird. Yeah. The parents will reject it. I mean, birds, songbirds have no sense of smell. It's an old wives' tale. You can manhandle chicks at any stage of the nesting cycle. And then put them back in the nest like researchers do, and there's no problem. You can put birds in other nests, to be fostered, and it often works out. So
we don't want to do that. We want to put them.
You don't want to do that. You want to put them back in the same nest, and you can strap it back up to the. People have done innovative things. You can kind of figure it out for yourself. I mean. Mm-hmm. Wildcare and Cape Wildlife are wonderful places, but boy, they're overwhelmed this time of year. If you can. They would probably say, no, bring it to us. But, there are things you can do that are logical as long as the birds are okay and get the chicks back in the nest.
All right. Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. See you next month.
All righty.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.